Kevin Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, cozy up with a hearty Italian ragu. Russ Parsons is here. I'll take you beyond the cupcake for a delicate and delicious macaron. Plus, Jonathan Gold is here with a restaurant for us to try. And there's just one more chance to support Good Food and KCRW by listening as a subscriber. We've got wine clubs, restaurants, classes, and a free dinner from yours truly. But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week with market manager Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with a market report. Pizza is one of the things that nobody can ever, ever get tired of. And I'm visiting with David Sandfield, who was the chef owner of a wonderful pizza place called Pitfire Artisan Pizza. He's got three locations, and he's going to be opening one in Culver City any day. And David, you've got a special wood fire, delicious hybrid pizza, and you've also got an amazing winter pizza flavor.
The pizza that we're running in the winter that I think most reflects what's happening in the market right now, although we're coming to the end of it, is our pumpkin pizza. We do roasted squash, mostly butternut, sometimes a little bit of kabocha, fontina cheese, toasted pepitas, toasted pepita oil, and sauteed greens, whatever's around. Sometimes it's cavolo nero, sometimes it's some nice kale. Yeah, and even a little bit of spinach sometimes. And it's a real light pizza. It doesn't have any sauce on it. It's just the roast. Oh, and you know, a little bit of brown butter. That's our secret.
When you do the squash, are you roasting it in chunks and then putting it on, or does everything cook on the pizza in the oven?
No. We cut the squash up in chunks with the skin on, rub it in olive oil, salt and pepper, a little bit of, throw some sage leaves and bay, and roast it till it's kind of crispy. Then we scoop out the chunks and break them up with our hands and lay them on the pizza.
Is there a way to take the skin off, or you just leave the skin on?
No, once you cook it, you just, with a spoon, just sort of spoon out the squash and leave the skin behind. I eat squash skin all the time, but not so nice on a pizza.
At what point is that brown butter tossed on there?
Okay, so we make brown butter by cooking whole butter slowly and letting it go nutty brown but not burnt. And if any milk solids start to burn, we just sort of spoon them out. We have that on the side. Doesn't even matter if it kind of goes to room temp a little bit and solidifies slightly. When the pizza's done, and I know this sounds decadent, we just take a little, very little bit, you know, what would be maybe one normal slice for toast, less than a tablespoon, and just break it up and let it melt on top of the pizza. Then we also do a very slight drizzle of super dark toasted pumpkin seed oil. Oh, and I should mention that we also sprinkle fleur de sel on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The gray fleur de sel.
David Sandfield, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure.
That was David Sandfield, and he's the proud owner of these wonderful Pitfire pizza places that have this hybrid crust, fresh ingredients from the farmer's market, and they sound fabulous. We have a wonderful new feature at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. It's also going to be over at the Hollywood Market on Sundays, except for the first Sunday of the month. Ernest Miller is a master food preserver, and he's going to be answering questions about your food preserving issues. And, you know, you think of food preserving as jam and jelly. Well, Ernest has a line of preserved items that are just so delectable looking. First of all, I want you to kind of give us a little rundown, Ernest, of what you have, and then tell us a little bit about the food preserving program, and hopefully it's going to be having a resurgence.
Food preservation itself is having quite a resurgence. People are very interested in it, and it's a way to eat local and sustainable throughout the year. Obviously, we're doing things like pickles and everything from pickled kumquats to pickled carrots, pickled cauliflower, pickled shallots, which the vinegar that's left over after that makes an incredible vinaigrette. We also do a lot of fermentation, drying, proper freezing techniques, smoking and curing, and then, of course, pressure canning, where we take care of meats and vegetables that need a little extra high temperatures for proper preservation.
And you're making this wonderful grenadine out of real pure pomegranate juice. Can you kind of explain that process a little?
Absolutely. The grenadine you buy in the stores nowadays is mostly artificially colored and flavored corn syrup. What grenadine really is just a pomegranate syrup, sugar, a little bit of lemon juice, but it has such bright, beautiful flavor and color, and it's perfectly cannibal. So you can make it and keep it on the shelf, and then you have those tequila sunrises and Shirley Temples whenever you want.
And we have a lot of farmers here who do sell pure pomegranate juice. Is that a good place to start rather than trying to juice your own pomegranate?
Absolutely. That obviously makes it a lot easier. You can juice your own pomegranates, and it's not that difficult. It can be a little messy, but the pomegranate juice, you can use it either to make the pomegranate grenadine, or you can also make pomegranate jelly.
So what are you canning right for this week?
This week, marmalades. A lot of citrus right now. It's very fresh. Also, preserved lemons. I've got some in the works as well.
All right, and I saw these preserved kumquats, and those look fabulous.
Kumquats make an incredible marmalade. Then there's so many other things you can do with them, as well as I have some pickled kumquats, which are excellent in salads, as a side dish to meats or charcuterie.
Well, this is opening up a whole new world for us as far as rethinking and maybe thinking about new flavors and tastes and finding things that we might want to just experiment with, and just from there, just keep it going and hopefully make this part of our cooking experience.
Well, I certainly hope so. I encourage everybody to do it. Last week in the rain, I made some cherry pie from some cherry pie filling from last spring, and it was so nice to have the flavor of spring, you know, in the middle of the rain last week.
All right, Ernest. Well, thank you so much. You're going to be here Wednesdays at the Santa Monica Market, the third Wednesday of the month. You're at the Hollywood Market every Sunday except the first Sunday of the month, so you're going to be in L.A. pretty much every week.
Absolutely. It's a great place to be.
I want to invite everybody to come to our next quarterly library panel. It's going to be Thursday, February 11th from 7 till 9 p.m. in the main auditorium, the Martin Luther King Auditorium at the Santa Monica Main Library. We're going to have four of the premium fruit experts in California who also happen to be farmers at this market talking about how to grow great fruit. This is an opportunity for people to learn what is perfection in fruit and how it's accomplished. And also, please join me in supporting KCRW with a pledge. It's really important to know that you can maintain and preserve this wonderful resource, which is KCRW. A little helps, everything helps. Please pick up the phone, join the crowd that does support this program and this radio station. Keep KCRW going, keep it strong, and keep the information on the air. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. And you can see videos from the Farmers Market, too, on the Good Food app for the iPhone and the iPod Touch. You'll notice that our show is a little shorter today. That's because we're in the second week of our winter subscription drive. That's the time of year when we ask you, dear listeners, for your dollars. KCRW is a public radio station, and we need your financial support to create the programming you love every week. Podcasters can donate just $5 a month. That's $1.25 per podcast. Please go to kcrw.com/join or just call 1-800-600-5279. Thanks, and now back to the show. Coming up next, a conversation with Russ Parsons about ragu. And I don't mean the sauce in the bottle. I mean the hearty Italian sauce made from lots of meat and loaded with flavor. That's next here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. There are some weekends when what I really want to do is spend a lot of time and make a beautiful, rich ragu. I know I'm not alone because recently I read Russ Parsons' thoughts on making ragu. Russ, of course, is the food editor and food columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Let's talk about ragu.
Let's.
What is it, first of all? Define it.
It is hard to define, actually, because it's a sauce. But it's not exactly a sauce. So I think, like, for me, the best definition that I could come up with is it's almost like the old East Coast Italian word gravy, because the really important thing about a good ragu is it's the meat. It's not a tomato sauce. It's meat that's cooked with tomatoes.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, ragu was the byproduct of braising the meat.
Right.
And what you would do is for your primo, for your first course, you would have some of the gravy over your pasta. And then for your secondo, for your main course, you would have the meat.
Right. And so it's almost like its byproduct has become more important than the product. But a nice piece of fatty pork, like a pork shoulder or pork butt, braised in the tomato sauce and just served by itself. It's like the Italian version of pulled pork. You know, it's so tender, it's so moist, and the flavor is just amazing.
So good. I sort of go crazy and I do like a 4-meat ragu.
Me too. I'll go you one better. I do a 4-pork ragu. I'm the pork boy. So prosciutto, pancetta, the pork butt, and then Italian sausage at the end.
Okay, I do country pork ribs, sausages, chicken thighs, and brajol.
That's interesting. So does the chicken thighs, it adds a little bit sweet rather than just like the pork flavor?
Yeah.
That's a nice combination. That's a nice idea. Well, that's a great thing about ragu, though, is that ragu isn't a recipe. It's like a construction method.
It's true. It's like a state of mind.
Yeah.
So when you make your ragu, are you braising large cuts of beef and then grinding them later and adding the meat in, or are you using ground beef?
Neither. As you know better than I do, there isn't a ragu. Everybody has a ragu. And I'm sure that, you know, even in Bologna, where, you know, it's like the most famous ragu is, every house, it's made slightly differently.
Okay, now, I would say that bolognese is not ragu. To me, bolognese should not be a tomato-based sauce. Bolognese should be meaty, 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 meat.
Mm-hmm. But the ragu that I love the best, I'm not that crazy about bolognese. I mean, it's like a guilty confession, but I'm not that crazy about bolognese. The ragu that I love the best is Napolitano, which is it's much more tomato-y. But you should see the emails that I got from Bologna. They very definitely believe that not only is bolognese a ragu, it is the ragu.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, so take me through your method I can learn what you're doing.
What I like to do is I start out with a seasoning base, with a sofrito. Usually what I do is I grind pancetta, prosciutto, and onion together, and garlic, of course, and then cook it in olive oil until it starts to color, and until you'll see that the onion will give up a lot of moisture. That moisture will start to evaporate. And at that point, I add a big piece of pork. And then cook that. And this is all done over like really slow heat. And then I brown that big piece of pork. And this can take like an hour. It can take an hour and 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes or so, you go in, give it a little bit of a turn. You get nice color to it, but you don't get the crust. It's a very slow brown. Once the pork is browned, I'll add red wine to it. Let it braise again. And again, it can take, you know, it can take an hour and a half, 2 hours in the wine. You don't want to take it down. This isn't French cooking. You know, you don't want to take it down to the point where it's a syrup, but you want it to reduce. And definitely it needs to lose all of that raw wine flavor so it becomes something else. At that point, the meat should be getting fairly tender. Take the meat out and put it on a plate and stir in tomato paste.
Okay, tomato paste. Tomato paste, for a lot of people, it's a really old-fashioned ingredient which has outlived its usefulness.
I understand that point of view. And that, I mean, in my opinion, that's because it is used incorrectly so often. I think the really important thing about tomato paste is browning it. If you just dump tomato paste into the tomato sauce, you know, it's not good. But if you take the time and you add it to the ragu a little bit at a time, a couple tablespoons at a time, and let each tablespoon mix into the sauce and brown. So the color is not red. The color is, it's like
brick.
A brick color. Then I add some fresh tomatoes, chopped fresh tomatoes, and put the meat back in and let it cook for another hour or so. You need to cook the meat to the point where, you know, when you put a carving fork in it, it just kind of slips in. Because there are several muscles there, they'll cook at different rates. And so, you know, you need to test it in a couple different places. When it's really, really tender, that's when I pull out the pork for the last time, and then crumble in Italian sausage, and then cook that for another hour. I really want like a chewy pasta to go with that. So I'll serve that with some kind of a dried pasta, preferably a good brand, and preferably a shape that has some ridges or has some corkscrew or something like that to hold the crumbles. Because at this point, all there is like, you know, it's like crumbles of meat in tomato sauce. It's amazing.
So
and then I'll usually serve the roast as a second course with something like, you know, like broccoli rabe or mustard greens or something that's got a little bit of a bitterness to it, because the meat itself is so unctuous at that point that you really need some kind of, you need a little bitterness just to throw it into perspective.
That sounds incredibly delicious. Russ Parsons is the editor of the LA Times food section. A recipe for his ragu is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Does the cupcake still reign supreme as the perfect handheld dessert? If you love it, go for it. But I've got another option for you, the macaron. I'll explore this French cookie next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. You may have noticed as you gad about all the different sweet shops in Los Angeles that little jewels of color have made their way everywhere, it seems. These are French macaroons or macarons. To talk to me about this phenomenon that's sweeping Los Angeles is Leslie Bala. She's the LA editor of TastingTable.com.
You know, macaroons, you can see them everywhere right now. We have French bakeries that have always carried them, like La Provence Bakery, which is in Beverly Hills and now in Brentwood. And they've always had at least 10 different flavors and beautifully colored little macaroons. Maybe not as petite as maybe the traditional French version, but they've always had them. And the little next door on West 3rd, they've always had them. You see them popping up in places where you didn't see them before. And also we have an all macaroon bakery in Beverly Hills as well, which I think is like the sprinkles. It's like the cupcake trend. I think it's stylish and a pretty little place. It's called Paulette. As stylish as it needs to be in Beverly Hills, and it's all macaroons, at least 10 different flavors every day, freshly made every day.
Now, we should say that these are not coconut macaroons. These are French macarons, which are like a tiny little cookie sandwich, and the outside is made of a meringue with ground almonds, and then it's colored.
The inside, like an Oreo cookie, it could be, you know, some sort of sweet buttercream frosting or a ganache or a caramel. It seems that most of these places, as in La Provence and Little Next Door, and Paulette as well, some of the more traditional flavors are pistachio. You can pretty much find everywhere. Lavender is also really a lovely one. And chocolate, of course. And there's some espresso. You'll find some coffee flavors. They're really great. I think why these are growing in such popularity as well is they're so simple. They're not too sweet.
Which is strange because you hear the word meringue and you think it's going to be really sickly sweet, but it isn't. And there's something about that texture of your tooth going into that meringue and breaking through it, but still finding just enough chewiness.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Like the really good ones should be like a crack, like an eggshell almost. And inside should be soft and fluffy. And then you get to this chewy part. These are thin cookies. It's not like you're going through a one-inch brownie getting all those textures. It's a simple little sandwich cookie, two little thin discs with some cream inside and not too sweet and different flavors. That,
and pretty.
And they are beautiful.
They're so pretty. There's something about the way the meringue takes to being dyed different colors that it has this sort of Easter egg kind of joyous fun about it.
So one of the places that has, actually, I think one of the more extreme colors that I've seen is at Bottega Louie downtown, because, you know, this is this huge Italian restaurant with this big bakery and takeout counter in the front, and it's that white marble place, and it's just really grand and ornate, and you walk in and their pastries are lined up along the windows, and it's beautiful, but their macaroons are these really bright, almost neon-colored cookies, and that it's really interesting. And those are good ones. I think the ones at Paulette are beautifully colored and more pastel, and they just look so artisanal and gorgeous and handcrafted, and the colors are bright and beautiful and inviting, but they're not, like, shocking in any way. You know, another really popular flavor seems to be salted caramel, and several places carry that. Europane in Pasadena, Sumi Chang's macaroons, people are just diehard fans of these. They're incredibly addictive. They're slightly larger, but just wonderful texture. They're almost as perfect as they can be. Another fleur de sel one you can find is at Tavern in Brentwood at the Larder. They're serving about four different kinds of macaroons a day, but I think the fleur de sel is always there. I think this is just one of those flavors. This goes back to the not too sweet thing. These cookies already aren't so sweet, but that little bit of sweetness and that little bit of salty, of course, there are people who just love that combination.
Now, what about Christy Chu over at Gin Patisserie?
Not only does she include the traditional flavors like a pistachio and salted caramel, she also has some really unique flavors like a sour plum and yuzu. They're also just beautiful, beautiful little cookies that it's like one of the best hostess gifts even. You know, they look so beautiful. They taste delicious.
I have to say that one of the most unique macarons I've seen, I saw as I was driving by Milk, and I was actually stopped at the stoplight on Poinsettia and Beverly, and I saw a woman walking out of Milk holding in her hand what looked like an ice cream sandwich, but it was a beautiful pink macaron on the outside. And I just thought to myself, genius, genius.
Yeah. Let's just talk about that for a second. So ice cream sandwiches are fantastic on their own. We love cookies. We love ice cream. Putting them together, fantastic. But a lot of times when you eat an ice cream sandwich, the cookie is hard or chewy and the ice cream moves out.
It pushes out.
Right. Using this meringue, the macaron cookie, is so genius because it's that soft, chewy, slightly crunched texture on the outside with ice cream in the middle. You can actually eat the whole thing in one bite. It all just melts in your mouth. So another large cookie that I found is at Lemonade, which has several locations around town. What a great, you know, it's a great grab-and-go deli. You can eat in there as well, and they have salads and things you can get, but they also have a lot of great pastries, and they make ginormous macarons. And these are just simple, two flavors. There's a chocolate one, there's a lemon one. Of course, it's lemonade. So, you know, really lovely lemon curd inside. Again, a little bit of tart sweetness and just a perfect combination.
Wow. Thank you so much,
Thank
Leslie.
Thank you. Anytime.
Leslie Ballas is the editor of Tasting Table LA, a weekly email newsletter. Find all of Leslie's macaron suggestions at kcrw.com/goodfood. I've got a recipe on how to make one at home there, too. Good Food wouldn't be good food without a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he's with me next. Stick around. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. It's that time of Saturday when many of us eagerly await Jonathan Gold's visit to Good Food. Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic from the LA Weekly, author of countless counterintelligence columns, and he's here to share another restaurant find with us. Where are we going?
Little Tokyo.
And what are we going to find there?
Not Japanese food, oddly enough. It's a place called Lazy Ox, or the Lazy Ox Canteen, which is the new restaurant from Joseph Centeno, who's a chef who has had many restaurants in Los Angeles over the years. And I think this is the first one that he's actually owned and has been fully his own.
And so what is the focus of Lazy Ox?
Lazy Ox, I think, is either a wine bar or a beer bar. I mean, they have some interesting beers. They don't have many places, like obscure Japanese things especially. Have you heard of a Ozeno Yukidoke IPA?
No.
I never had either, but it's good. And small dishes, like pretty much every other place in town, but very, very, very cross-cultural in a delightful way.
Okay, take us on a little cross-cultural tour of Lazy Ox.
Well, first, there are usually fried pig's ears. I think you have to have pig's ears to open in this town.
That's true. That's true.
But you'd expect it with something crazy, but he does it with a pretty classic sauce Raifort, the like horseradish cream. It's good, or a really good way to start.
Are they braised or are they shatteringly crisp? Which way does he go?
It's braised and then fried. So it has none of the sort of hard rubber chewiness that you expect from the Asian versions, and it's not quite as French fry-like as the version at, say, Church and State. And I think the best thing that I've had there was a soup, seemingly really simple dish. It was like roasted picea peppers. They're pureed and spicy. And there's like new sort of vegetable depths in every bite. The more you ate it, the more you wanted. And he put a big handful of fried chicharrones in there.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Fresh chicharrones with the crispness like melting into the, you know, wetness, I guess. There's got to be a better word than wetness. The smoothness. And something that you would think would be like vegetarian, in fact, takes on heretofore unknown carnivorous depths.
That sounds delicious.
But yet, on the other hand, he has things like a roasted farro with fennel and pureed Jerusalem artichokes that is like health food.
On steroids.
Exactly.
I love Jerusalem artichokes, and they're really underused.
Especially this time of year when you don't have to peel them.
I'd love to eat them just raw.
That's a good way, too. A really good way. They do merguez sausage with pears that have been poached with licorice, which is a nice combination.
So merguez is the Moroccan lamb sausage,
right.
That's slightly spicy. And then pears poached with licorice?
Right.
Like licorice stalks?
I think licorice root. I don't think it's anise because it doesn't have that sweetness. But it's a good flavor, and it works, you know, really well with the sausage, which has its own spicy thing going on. There's a, you know, charred octopus salad that a lot of people seem to have this time of year. For some reason, I'm seeing at a lot of restaurants lately, French fries with dill.
French fries with dill?
Right. You put the dill right in to fry. And it's a good combination. My prediction is that will end up being one of the most popular preps of 2010.
So the fried sage leaf is now being replaced by the fried dill.
Right.
Interesting. I have to try that.
One of the other things that he does that is unexpected is he's always, at all his restaurants, he's had paleron, which is a slice of beef shoulder. It's the same thing that they call flat iron steak, but, you know, bigger and treated as a pot roast as opposed to grilled like a steak. And he gets it to this really almost luxurious softness. And he puts it on a bed of cream of wheat, which sounds odd.
No, that sounds wonderful to me. I mean, it's sort of like polenta.
Yeah, and puts fresh kumquats with it. And it sounds like an odd combination, but it completely comes together.
Wow, that sounds really delicious.
As usual with like brand new restaurants with really creative chefs, one out of three dishes is going to make you scratch your head and wonder why he decided to put this on the menu. But it's okay. You make mistakes and then your restaurant becomes stronger. It's much better than opening yet another place with Kobe sliders.
So once again, Jonathan, tell us where we've just been eating.
We've been talking about the Lazy Ox Canteen on San Pedro in Little Tokyo.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold's the food writer for the LA Weekly. He joins me here nearly every week. Find all of his restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. You know that you can podcast or download this show, find all past episodes, pictures, recipes, and info on all our guests at kcrw.com/goodfood. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced and edited by Harriet Ells, with help from Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Candace Moyer, and Jillian Ferguson. Gary Messiha is our music supervisor. Please take a minute and support us. Support KCRW by going to kcrw.com/join or call us at 1-800-600-KCRW. Consider giving just $5 per month. It would mean so much to me if you did. We'll be back next week with a full hour of good food right here on KCRW and kcrw.com.